There was a Unitarian church in some Midwestern state a few years back. They made headlines because they had a big signboard out in front of their church. And the signboard said, "We don't do guilt here." I wasn't impressed. Suppose that church had been a courthouse instead. Or a prosecutor's office. Suppose Robert Mueller's team tweeted out, "We don't do guilt." How happy the White House would be. I think that guilt is a useful concept. It's often an appropriate emotion, because the world as I see it is filled with victims and with perpetrators. It's filled with trusting people and those who abuse that trust. It's filled with bullies and the criminally minded and those they prey on. Guilt is the moral category. We assign a behavior that is antisocial, that's hurtful, lying, cheating, slandering, other forms of malicious mischief. I have no problem labeling purse snatchers or investment scammers on Wall Street as sinners or crooks or scoundrels. In my opinion, we should occasionally feel some sense of remorse for our actions. And I have no quarrel with the traditional language of the prayer book. We have not done the things we ought to have done, and we have not done the things we ought. But if I believe in guilt, I don't believe in shame, which is an entirely separate phenomenon. Guilt attaches to our actions, what we do, while shame invades our identity, who we are. So, for example, the priest who molests a little boy may or may not suffer from any scruples of conscience. But that child who's raped will almost certainly carry a crippling stigma of shame, a debilitating sense of being soiled or rendered abnormal or deviant from being an unwilling participant in an obscene act. Bill Cosby pled not guilty to the charges of sexual assault leveled against him. And he probably feels blameless, like so many other powerful men who hunt down younger, more vulnerable women. But while Bill and Donald and Roy Moore may feel no compunctions, the women that they violated more than likely felt stupid or foolish or tarnished or embarrassed or mortified, a word that comes from the root mort, meaning death. Shame kills. It represents an inward annihilation. To speak more personally, I remember feeling guilty when I was a child in my one experiment with shoplifting. Yeah, I tried to stole a whistle. Actually, Freddie Cohen told me to do it. I'll blame it on him. But the store owner caught me. I wasn't a very good thief. And he told me never to come back into his store, and the pang of contrition from getting caught was a healthy and useful reaction, because I didn't grow up to become a bank robber. In fact, I never stole again. On the other hand, I feel I remember feeling a deep sense of shame as a young child when I was 5 years old and my father died. And then when father and son picnics would be announced at school, or I would see the other dads coaching Little League, I would get a lump in my throat. I would feel estranged, like the outsider who could never be part of the team. I was ashamed to be different, less than, not good enough. And this wasn't a helpful emotion. It was one that made me, as a little boy, want to hide or disappear or sink into the ground. And what I experienced then as a child was, again, a sense of premature burial. Now, maybe this minor personal confessional has made you think of times in your own life when you may have felt ashamed. The day your parents disowned you because you were gay, or the semester you were held back a grade because you hadn't learned how to read, or how you felt after you lost your job through no fault of your own, or when you couldn't pay your rent. Shame burdens each of us in differing ways, arising from the wounds, the insults we all suffer in our brokenness and humanity, but its effect is always the same: to chill the joy of living. But if shame is a powerful force today, it was even more potent in the ancient world, when modern ethical distinctions of right and wrong, vice and virtue, were secondary to Greco-Roman categories of honor and dishonor, and to reigning Jewish constructs of purity and pollution. In that classical period when Jesus lived, there were whole classes of people who were considered to be a dirty, filthy, loathsome, who were sinners, not because of any lapse in their conduct or character, but rather due to their social or economic station or other externals. So, for instance, physical health and vigor, athleticism and beauty were associated with honor and purity. But people who were maimed or disfigured or afflicted with disabling diseases or leprosy were considered to be degraded. Literally, these individuals were untouchables, as is written in Leviticus. The leper, he shall dwell alone, outside the camp shall his habitation be. Often the sufferers gathered in colonies outside the city gates, shunned by the better sort of citizen, giving a whole new depth of understanding to stories like the one recorded in the Gospel of Mark. And there came a leper to him, beseeching him, kneeling down to him, saying, "If thou wilt, thou canst make me clean." And Jesus, moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him. So did you notice the man didn't ask to be cured or healed? He asked to be made clean. The leprosy did actually get better, the story says, but the emphasis is less on a medical miracle than on a spiritual reality. Being cleansed, I interpret, not just in a ritual or ceremonial sense, but as a holistic response to the therapeutic power of touch and simple human contact. Imagine spending your whole life living among people who consider themselves to be your betters, who are repulsed by your very existence. When one of those strangers comes forward as a peer and reaches out his hand in comfort and support, the shame of being sick was lifted because, as the story says, Jesus was moved with compassion, which is a term that in both Hebrew and Aramaic is the plural of a noun that in its singular form is usually translated as womb or uterus. So a mother feels compassion for the child stirring inside her that is the flesh of her flesh. A man responds with compassion to his brother because they come from the same womb. So when Jesus advises his listeners, be ye compassionate as God is compassionate, he's saying that, the greatest force in the universe is like a mother's love for her children, indiscriminate and unconditional, not favoring those who are especially gifted with good looks or good health or good fortune, but most of all concerned with those who are lost or struggling or alone. Jesus challenged the social and religious caste systems of his day because he himself was born among the outcasts. Being rich didn't necessarily guarantee your purity in that ancient Jewish world, but it certainly didn't hurt, while being destitute was almost surely a sign of shame and defilement, if only because you couldn't afford sacrifices. And Jesus was undoubtedly poor, of doubtful parentage. Men and women, males and females, had differing degrees of purity in that patriarchal culture. The natural bodily processes of childbirth and menstruation being associated with uncleanness. But the lowest of the low, those on the very bottom, were the ones born out of wedlock, of illegitimate unions, the products of incest or adultery. These were known in the Jewish law as the mamzerim. The Orthodox would not be allowed to marry such offspring, nor could mamzers inherit or hold public office. Bastards were commonly called the excrement of the community, and it's libel that Jesus belonged to this despised and expendable class. The earliest Christian writer, Paul, says little about his origins except that Jesus was, quote, born of woman. Now, that is in the usual way. And that he had a brother, James. In Mark, which is generally accepted as the earliest of the four Gospels, there are no birth stories at all, but Mark does make one fascinating mention of Jesus' family when the residents of Nazareth take offense at his teaching. They ask, is not this the carpenter, the son of Miriam, and brother of Jacob, and Yose, and Yehuda, and Shimeon, and are not his sisters here with us, making for at least six siblings and a mother with no hint of a father at all? This is highly unusual for a period when Yeshua bar Yosef would have been the ordinary way of referring to a young man, Jesus, whose male parent was Joseph. Mark never mentions any father figure, however. And later Jewish law would consider a man illegitimate who was called just son of Mary by only his mother's name. It was not long at all after Jesus' death that the little Christian community in Jerusalem began to spread out to the corners of the Mediterranean. And the gospel accounts that emerged from that dispersion were influenced by the folklore of those regions where deities born of virgins abounded. There was Horus from Egypt, Attis from Phrygia, Adonis from Babylon, Mithra from Persia, all from maidens born. What was unusual and to Gentile ears slightly unnerving and scandalous about the nativity legends was not that a man would be divine or have a miraculous birth, because nearly all the great potentates in those days claimed some degree of godhood. What was scandalous was that this kind of a man, a nobody, an illiterate, an impoverished peasant, a mamzer, would have that kind of grand genealogy. And the later Gospels do recall something of Jesus' dubious background. In the Magnificat, Luke speaks of Mary's lowliness or low estate. The Greek word usually translated humiliation, but why Mary was humiliated, why she felt a loss of face or felt ashamed, we can only speculate. The Gospel of Matthew says that her husband Joseph was minded to dissolve their betrothal and put her away privately, finding her to be pregnant before they'd had relations with each other. But both Gospel writers, following the mythic pattern prevalent around the ancient Near East, went on to insist that Jesus was born to a virgin, a claim that would have growing consequences for the church as sexuality, and particularly female sexuality, became associated with dark forces. Now, illicit sex, transgressions like adultery, these carried a social stain in Judaism, but in a religion where God commanded the Hebrews to be fruitful and to multiply, sex itself was never considered to be an evil per se. It was a positive good. So Paul, who of course was a Jew, testifies that his colleague, the Apostle Peter, had a wife, as did other disciples, and Jesus himself is frequently called rabbi by the crowd at a time when being married was usually a requirement for the rabbinate. Many have pointed out that the wedding at Cana, where Jesus turns water into wine, may be a thinly veiled account of Christ's own wedding. After all, Jesus and his mother are both depicted as being present at this ceremony. His mother's worried that the guests are running out of wine, quite as though she were the hostess of this affair. Both of them are pictured giving orders to the servants, as if this were their own home. And when Jesus manufactures more, the head waiter or steward refers to Jesus as the bridegroom, congratulating him on saving the best wine for last. But gradually, the disciples came to be depicted as an all-male band. Mary Magdalene, who was at very least a close associate and devoted follower, if not the spouse of Jesus, was reduced to the role of a prostitute. The fact that Jesus had brothers and sisters and normal family ties was quietly suppressed. For the virgin birth evolved into the dogma of Mary's perpetual virginity, then her immaculate conception, finally, her bodily assumption into heaven, until in our own time, Pope John Paul II, the late spiritual leader of the world's 1 billion Catholics, could proclaim that a man sins when he lusts for his own wife. Sex itself became a source of shame in Christianity. To love for comfort, for closeness, for any reason except procreation was deemed unholy. And the religion that Jesus lived and taught, the religion of compassion, where love was likened to the womb of a woman nurturing and embracing all her children, became a religion where only those who had no wombs were qualified to be priests or handle the instruments of salvation, a Christian morality of purity and pollution, 100 times stricter than those practiced by the Pharisees came into being. And this is why it is important to me, especially at Christmas, to separate the actual teachings of Jesus from the myths that rose up around him after his death. Jesus taught that sin is whatever separates us from our neighbor. Healing and salvation is whatever restores our sacred sense of self-worth as equal citizens in the kingdom, enabling us to participate again in the mutuality of caring community. But the religion of Jesus is very different than the religion about Jesus, which has all too often been guilty of perpetuating modern caste systems, separating the Orthodox from the heretic, engendering sexism and anti-Semitism, fostering homophobia, glorifying poverty rather than challenging the power inequities that create it. If Jesus were alive today, it's these social sins of racism and sexism and militarism that constitute the real offenses against human dignity, that demean whole religions, whole classes and races and genders, tangling men in a warped sense of entitlement, trapping women in a false sense of abnegation, separating us from nature, from our own bodies, disrupting the actual unity of the family of God. So I will tell stories of Bethlehem and Herod, wise men and shepherds, because I like these stories. I grew up with them. But at the same time, I feel compelled to criticize them and try to separate the chaff of fabrication from the grain of truth they contain, precisely because these myths are so enchanting. They need to be examined and unpacked. Call me old-fashioned, or call me scholarly, but it is the man behind the legends that I celebrate this time of year, not some pre-existent logos or person in the Trinity, but a flesh and blood individual who was extraordinary, not for the manner of his conception, but for the manner of his living, whose teachings of radical compassion and unconditional co-humanity ring across the centuries like tidings of comfort and joy.